This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Boardwalk Empire, a new drama series about Atlantic City and organized crime in the era of Prohibition, premiered this month on HBO. The first episode was directed by Martin Scorsese. After it was televised, Boardwalk Empire immediately was renewed by HBO for a second season. Our guest today is Terrence Winner, creator of Boardwalk Empire. He's comfortable with HBO and with TV mobsters. He wrote and or produced some 24 hours of The Sopranos, including the classic Pine Barrens episode. Boardwalk Empire is HBO's biggest and most expensive prestige project since The Sopranos. It stars Steve Buscemi as Nucky Thompson, an Atlantic City politician who sees the coming of Prohibition as an opportunity to make even more money from illegal activities and kickbacks. And he's right. I spoke to Terrence Winner just a few days before the premiere of Boardwalk Empire. Terrence Winner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You come from HBO's The Sopranos, where you won 4 Emmys and were nominated for lots more for producing, writing, or co-writing individual episodes. And it's clear that HBO really, really wanted another organized crime series. If I understand this correctly, instead of you pitching a series idea to them, they pitched one to you, based on Nelson Johnson's book, Boardwalk Empire.
Well, that's true. They didn't really specifically ask for or necessarily, in as far as I knew, want an organized crime series. They really just gave me the book. Nelson's book is essentially a history book involving the history of Atlantic City from when it was literally a mosquito-infested swamp until the present day. And all they said to me was, here, look at this book, see if you can find the television series in there. There were several eras in the history of Atlantic City that I found appealing, the 20s, the 50s, and the 70s. And I arrived at the 20s. And naturally, in the era of Prohibition, you are going to encounter gangsters. I think I sing a few songs, and I sing them well, and one of them is the mob genre, as a writer. So that's material that's always interesting to me. And then the 1920s just offered this incredible sweeping time in American history and with a lead character at its center that was just absolutely compelling and a guy that I couldn't wait to set a TV series around.
Well, let's give a taste of all of that. Here's a very quick taste from the pilot episode. It's a few hours before the start of Prohibition, and Nucky Thompson, an Atlantic City power broker played by Steve Buscemi, is addressing a private meeting with the mayor and city council. It's written by you, and it's directed by Martin Scorsese.
Boys, boys, boys. Mr. Mayor, friends, fellow members of the city council. As you know, in less than 2 hours, liquor will be declared illegal by decree of the distinguished gentlemen of our nation's Congress. To those beautiful, ignorant bastards.
That was actor Steve Buscemi in a scene from Boardwalk Empire, the new drama series from HBO. My guest is the creator of the series, Terrence Winner. In the nonfiction book on which Boardwalk Empire is based, Nucky Johnson, whom you call Nucky Thompson, is only in a few chapters in the middle of the book. So why did you decide to start with his story?
Nucky, the real Nucky, was an incredibly charismatic character. Even though he was the county treasurer, he was the guy who ran the city. I mean, automatically that got my attention. I mean, how's the guy who essentially is third or fourth rung on the food chain politically, the guy who's in charge of everything? And it's all by design. He was sort of the guy behind the scenes, but nothing moved in that city without him. He was incredibly duplicitous. On the one hand, a really beloved politician. On the other hand, incredibly corrupt and, sort of veering toward low-level gangsterism in the sense of, white-collarish crimes. He had been the sheriff himself at one point, election rigging, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, it presented a main character that was sort of equal parts politician and gangster, which was fascinating. Just a really interesting backstory. He, had grown up there, worked his way up. As I said, he was the sheriff, ultimately gained control of the city and was beloved. I mean, even though he's clearly corrupt, I don't think he ever made more than $6,000 a year legitimately on the books, yet his residence was the entire 8th floor of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And they kept electing these guys in. And I said that, this is a compelling character.
Why change his last name? It's sort of like Ragtime where, you know, you have some real characters like Al Capone that remain correctly identified and others who are given different names or who are created by you out of whole cloth. How'd you decide what to do with whom?
I had been a big fan of the show Deadwood on HBO, which was created by David Milch.
Me too.
And as soon as I heard that they were – all of those characters were based on real people, you know, the first thing I did was Google everybody. And I read about it. So it was interesting and fascinating to me. So I would just Google all the different characters. So pretty quickly I became ahead of the story. Al Swearengen, for example, who was played by Ian McShane, lived until the 20th century, I learned. Mm-hmm. And then whenever I would watch Deadwood and if Al Swearengen was in a situation where there was jeopardy, I'd say to myself, well – he's not going to die. And then I thought, I shouldn't know that. You know, it's really taking away from my experience. And I'm sure David Milch doesn't want me to know that. But because the show was so good, I was inclined to want to know more about it. So I realized early on the same thing might happen here. You know, people start to look at Nucky and then compare what happened to the real Nucky as compared to our Nucky and know where the story's going. We already had enough real characters on the show or people based in real life that everyone knows what happened to Al Capone and, you know, maybe to a lesser extent Lucky Luciano and Arnold Rothstein. But if everybody is real, I can't play – you know, I can't manipulate the story the way I want to. So, you know, the other thing too is, you know, I don't know if the real Nucky got involved in some of the things I may choose to have our Nucky do. So I said, you know what, he's Nucky, but he's not Nucky. He's based on Nucky clearly, but our Nucky can do any number of things. And, you know, it sort of takes the handcuffs off of being, you know, married to the reality there. And I think it gives us the creative license to really go anywhere we want to go.
Once you decide on having Nucky as your central character, you then have to cast him. And
yes.
I love Steve Buscemi. Am I pronouncing his last name correctly, by the way?
Well, he pronounces it Buscemi.
Well, he's
but
probably
then I heard
correct.
Him say he says he doesn't he says actually in Italy it is pronounced Buscemi. And so he doesn't correct people when they say Buscemi. Most people say Buscemi, and I've sort of made it a personal cause of mine to get people to pronounce it correctly. It's also Martin Scorsese and Steve Buscemi. And I'm guilty of calling him Martin Scorsese for the last 30 years, but he calls himself Martin Scorsese. So I just – it's always in my head Scorsese Buscemi.
All right. I'll try
but
to play by
we
those
We all know
rules.
Who we're talking about. It's almost impossible.
But anyway, whoever he is, we'll say yes. Steve Buscemi. He is terrific in this.
Yes.
And just as he was terrific in supporting roles in Fargo and The Big Lebowski and so many other films. But how did you and Martin Scorsese choose him as a leading man?
You know, originally, you know, in doing the research, we looked at pictures of the real Nucky, and I had gone down to Atlantic City on, you know, research trips, by which I mean to drink and gamble, and just informally polled people that I would meet down there and asked them, do you know who Nucky Johnson is? And almost nobody knew. So we realized early on he's sort of an obscure historical character. Nobody knows what he looks like. It doesn't matter anyway. So rather than be wedded to what the real guy looked like, and he was a big, booming, you know, barrel-chested, balding guy. You know, actually, I've said, you know, had we wanted to cast somebody who looked like the real Nucky, we would have gone to James Gandolfini, who had just finished The Sopranos, and that probably wouldn't have worked out anyway because I think he was ready to take a little break. So we said, let's forget about what the real guy was and let's just find the best actor. And we started kicking around names, and I'm pretty sure it was me who suggested Steve at first. And Marty responded immediately. He said, "Guy, I love him. I worked very briefly with him on a film called New York Stories I did a long time ago. I would love to work with him again."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I've worked with him on The Sopranos. He's terrific. I think he'd be great." And we kept batting around names for a few more days, and Marty called me and said, "I can't stop thinking about Steve Buscemi." And I said, "I can't either." And he said, "Let's do it." And I said, "Great."
If you're just joining us, our guest is Terrence Winter, creator of the new HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Prohibition. Can you explain how Atlantic City fit into the picture in those days? Because if I've got this right, New Jersey and Pennsylvania were both dry states on Sundays, you know, even before Prohibition, but Atlantic City just didn't care. And how did it fit into the whole East Coast Midwest crime scene?
Well, you know, the happy accident for Nucky Johnson and our fictional Nucky Thompson is that you have a corrupt politician who runs a city that is actually on the ocean, and suddenly alcohol is illegal, and alcohol comes in through that ocean. So it was really just a gift from the gods to a corrupt person. They say prohibition was only a rumor in Atlantic City, and I believe that the, you know, the dry Sunday law was also just a rumor. Apparently nothing changed at all, which has actually presented us with a little difficulty on the show, because if nothing changed and alcohol was served just as openly in Atlantic City the next day, then we really don't have a lot of conflict because it's supposed to be illegal. So we actually probably fictionalize the fact that it's actually a little bit of a problem, that they do have to go to some pains to hide things. But yeah, I mean, it was just an unbelievable opportunity for a man who ran a town on the seaboard, because suddenly he had friends from all over the country, people who wanted to get to know him and go in business with him. And all that alcohol came, you know, down from Canada, up from the Bahamas, just however they could get it there. And this was a safe haven. It was a port. You could come in. And of course, Nucky got a piece of everything that came in. But suddenly he became friends with Arnold Rothstein, you know, Johnny Torrio from Chicago, Waxy Gordon from Philadelphia, Lucky Luciano as a young man. All of those guys wanted to vie for his attention, and you know, certainly got off to a rocky start, but it was a pretty lucky break for Nucky.
And you kept them as with their real last names because this is early in their careers, and so you're not really spoiling any surprises. Is that the thinking?
Yeah, you know, they're so well known, unlike Nucky, that it would be, you know, if I called him, you know, Sal Carbone, it would be pretty obvious it's Al Capone. Nucky, people don't really know, you know,
I liked
who he was anyway.
It took me a second to get that clever alias you did right on the spot there.
Thanks. But yeah, he, you know, those guys are so bigger than life. You know, I wanted to present them as honestly as possible. And then for me as a writer, I mean, the idea of being able to portray Al Capone as a bumbling, you know, third banana of the guy, you know, who's running Chicago at the time was just irresistible. We always see Al Capone at the height of his power, you know, when he's mm-hmm. Scarface. This is the kid who's a little unsure of himself and doesn't quite know how to handle situations and is vulnerable and actually has a wife and a young son who we'll get to meet in the series. And it's just such a great opportunity to see how this guy formed into the Al Capone we know. Same with Rothstein, same with Luciano and others that are will appear on the show.
Well, that I've seen six episodes, and it seems from the very start that the generational war is as important to you as the territorial one. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's sort of the old story in organized crime, or probably in any business endeavor. You know, the young guys are hungry and you want to come up, and the old guys are a little fat and placated and don't want to, you know, rock the boat. And certainly Prohibition, you know, offered this huge opportunity to make a ton of money. And, you know, as you see in the series and, you know, as borne out by history, Big Jim Colosimo in Chicago wasn't really interested in illegal alcohol. He was making a ton of money running whorehouses and trafficking in other areas of crime. And it felt like it was more trouble than it was worth. And of course, the young guys saw him leaving millions of dollars on the table. And as usually happens, they moved him out of the way. And it happens all the time. It's sort of the way it works. When the young guys see an opportunity, I think if you're in charge, you better go along with that or start seriously thinking about cashing in the retirement plan.
In the 20s, you've got two movements going on at the same time. One is Prohibition and the other is suffrage, you know, women's rights. And yet somehow those two movements went hand in hand or certainly helped each other. How did that work?
Prohibition was a long time coming. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. There were anti-saloon leagues, and you know, from the mid 19th century on, you know, there was a movement to outlaw alcohol, and that's one of the things we took some pains to explore on the show. A lot of times in the 1920s, in the Prohibition era, and the women behind the temperance movement are sort of depicted as a bunch of killjoys and party poopers, and you know, they want to prevent people from having a good time. There was a real reason for Prohibition, a real reason for wanting it. There weren't social programs set up in the older days when, you know, if dad was an alcoholic and the breadwinner was not making money, families were destroyed. Kids didn't eat. Kids went to orphanages. Women were destitute. And, you know, even though the experiment of Prohibition failed miserably, there was a real reason for it. But it, you know, in passing Prohibition, I think, you know, it gave women power. I mean, it really showed that when they banded together and the Prohibition, the temperance movement was pretty much made up of women. When they banded together, they could get things done. So the getting the vote coming in the same year was sort of just obviously the next level of power for women. And we get to explore. I mean, both of those things happened in the same year, which is just incredible.
On The Sopranos, you worked under David Chase, and one of your writing partners was Matt Weiner, who went on to create Mad Men. What did you take away the most, about creating characters and about, the pace of The Sopranos? The patience of it was so unusual, and the way characters wouldn't say what they thought all the time. I mean, what did you learn while you were there?
Well, just that. If you're truly depicting human behavior in an honest way, it is a lot of miscommunication, non-communication, paranoia, passive aggressiveness. People don't finish sentences. They don't say what they mean. They lie to each other. They take credit for things that are actually other people's ideas. I mean, all of this stuff is just delicious when you're creating characters, because and The Sopranos was one of the first places I ever saw where it really felt like real people. I mean, completely honest. And people don't always have the right words. They don't have the ability to stand up and eloquently state their case. They fumfer. They backtrack. This is I'm doing now, and that's more real. And that's what David taught us. Trust that it's okay. It's actually better that way. And David's biggest lesson I learned from him, and this is very simple, but it seems like it should be obvious, but it's not. He just said, be entertaining. That's your job. Be entertaining. That's what this is. And it's not written on a sign in my writer's room, but it should be, those two words.
So if the biggest lesson that you learned from David Chase was to be entertaining, what's the biggest lesson you learned when you finally got to work with Martin Scorsese?
It was very different. In TV, writers generally are the showrunners, and they have enormous control over everything. In feature films, very often the writer will turn in a script and never be heard from again. Marty was incredibly collaborative and solicitous of my opinion with things, which was just incredible. I mean, really, he approached television completely differently because it's something he didn't really know about necessarily. He didn't really watch TV. He just really is a cinema buff, obviously, and television was something new. So even early on in the process, I had to describe how the TV season worked. And early on, he started reading some of the early scripts for the show, and he called me up and he said, "God, this is great. You get to see what happens to the characters after the movie is over." So for him, the pilot is the movie, and then everything else is after the movie. So I thought, well, that's such a – of course that's how he sees this. This is the movie and then later.
That's funny.
Endless number of sequels. It was, again, a whole different thing for me. I mean, obviously I defer to him creatively, whatever, across the board. I mean, he set the template for what the show looks like and feels like, and the tone visually and in so many other ways. But again, he was enormously collaborative, and it was great. So, I think one of the things I took away from that was that here's a man who is, an icon of cinema and is just, one, for my money, the best American director ever. And if he's comfortable enough to come into a situation and surround himself with people who may know more about that medium than he does and ask questions and actually be inclusive, I said that's something to take away, is that, you can be confident enough. Certainly he knows he's Martin Scorsese, and he knows what to do, but he's comfortable enough to let you actually take part in that, and it was great.
HBO threw so much money at this thing. If the estimates that I've seen in print are true, it's like $20 million for the pilot. Is that anywhere near?
That's fair.
That's fair?
Yes, that's a fair estimate.
That's like
yes.
Twice the pilot for Lost, which made headlines for how much that cost just a few years ago.
I don't think it's twice.
Okay.
I think Lost was about $14
million. All right. So how was it spent? I mean, I know you have a set in Brooklyn, and I want you to describe that. But what was important for you to get on the screen and why?
Well, I kept a lot of that money. HBO doesn't know this, but we funneled it into a bank account in Queens.
How appropriate for an Atlantic City sort of history story.
No, seriously. I mean, this obviously the expense of this endeavor was something that was very apparent to me early on, even reading the book and looking at pictures of what the old Atlantic City looked like. It's not there anymore. And I, you know, was kind of disheartened because I started to really get interested in doing this, and then I thought, there's no way we can afford to do this. I mean, we on a television budget, we cannot afford a boardwalk or an empire. And it's ludicrous to do a series about Atlantic City and never go to the boardwalk. I mean, we'd be have characters just refer, oh, I was just on the boardwalk. It looks great. And just hear music and the sound of the ocean and never see it. So this is insane. You know, why are we doing this? And I thought my pilot script is going to be one of these things that people read and say, yeah, it was really fun and great, but, you know, we really can't do this. And I was watching John Adams on HBO, the miniseries, and mm-hmm. they did a behind-the-scenes segment. And I saw what they were able to do digitally. There's one moment in particular. They showed Paul Giamatti riding a horse across an open field, and then suddenly, digitally in the background, the city of Boston circa 1774 appeared. And at that moment, I said, we can actually do this. This is possible. It's still going to be expensive, but it's doable. Now we can put it in a framework of a TV series that actually might work. And, you know, it's fair to say it's akin to the show Rome in terms of budget and scope and also a massive period piece. But that's in the business model. We might be able to make this work. So, yeah, I mean, I knew building – we needed a boardwalk. We had to build it ultimately, and we scouted locations starting in the real Atlantic City to Asbury Park, and then ultimately it became – more cost-effective to build a replica that is literally the size of a football field in Brooklyn and then augment that digitally. And that was the work of our amazing production designer, Bob Shaw. And then everything else, just the – you know, we decided – you know, and this was, again, the choice of Mr. Scorsese was, are we going to try to depict the reality of what Atlantic City in 1920 looked like, or is it going to be a stylized version of that? And we opted for reality, and which meant – great pains had to be taken to get things right. Hair, makeup, clothing, details of every kind, the props, every set was really fine-tooth combed and really did incredible amounts of research. So, and that all, you know, it all costs money. Just to do a street scene in Brooklyn requires 2 days of prep to get the street. And this is, you know, you say, oh, all the buildings are from the correct period, but air conditioners, street lights, pavement, mailboxes, there's any number of things that have to be removed, covered up, taken out, cleaned up, dirtied up, as the case may be. Mm-hmm. So it's a real everything costs money, of course. And I think it's all up there on the screen, though.
We're talking with Terrence Winter, creator of the new HBO series Boardwalk Empire. The story of how you got into show business is a great story, but I'm not even sure I believe it. Can you tell it briefly? I mean, I know that – you know, just go for it.
Okay. Grew up in Brooklyn, blue-collar family, went to a very blue-collar vocational high school, studied auto mechanics, had a high school teacher who told me I had a knack for writing. Didn't really plan on going to college. Ultimately, I did. Went to NYU, studied journalism, political science, worked my way through school. I was a doorman, and when I graduated, I found out that journalists made half the money that doormen make. So even though I was maybe interested,
yeah, keep going.
Yeah, initially, yeah, certainly. And I said, well, I want to make a lot of money. So the only two jobs I knew that paid a lot of money were doctor and lawyer. So I went to law school. And went to night school, worked my way through, was miserable, absolutely not the career for me. And I spent 2 years as the world's worst lawyer in Manhattan and finally did some soul searching and said, I want to be a writer. That's really what I want to do. And I packed up. I had never been west of Chicago. I had never written a script either. But I knew instinctively that this was something I could do. And I showed up in Los Angeles, got a job so I could pay my bills during the day and started writing spec scripts at night. Spec script being a sample script that you use as a calling card to get mm-hmm. on a show. And you know, up until that point in my life, I was pretty good at getting to be where I wanted to be. I was always able to achieve what I wanted and meet my goals. And finally, I finally identified the thing I really want to do, and I just cannot break into this business. It's the catch-22 in writing or in Hollywood is that you can't get a job unless you have an agent, and you can't get an agent unless you have a job.
Right, right.
So even though I had scripts people loved, they said, well, you know, you need an agent. And I just could not – I would cold call agents and have great conversations, and then inevitably weeks would go by and they'd say, who are you again? And it was just impossible. So I went down to the Writers Guild, and they had a list of agents who would take unsolicited material. And one of the names on a list was a guy I went to law school with. And I called him up in New York and I asked him, are you an agent now? And he said, no, I'm a real estate attorney. But one of my clients wrote a book on real estate and I used my fee to get bonded as an agent, but I don't know anything about it. And I said, well, I don't either, but I need an agent. And guess what? You're my agent. So he said, okay. I said, here's the deal. I'm going to create an agency. I'm going to come up with a phony name. I'll get a mailboxes, et cetera, address. I'll get letterhead. I'll get a voicemail system. I'll submit my scripts under your name. If we get anything, I'll give you 10% like a real agent. And he said, all right, great. So anyway, I photocopied all my scripts and I took a day off from work and I literally hit every sitcom office in LA and I gave my scripts and I told whoever was sitting behind the desk, I said, yeah, hi, I'm the messenger from the agency. These are those scripts you wanted. And the kid behind the desk would say, oh, okay. And so at least my scripts now were theoretically in buildings where people could hire me and they would read them because they did come in from an agent. So a couple of weeks went by and it was a Friday afternoon and our voicemail had a message. And I listened and it was the executive producer of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, a woman named Winifred Hervey Stallworth. And she said, yeah, hi, Doug. This is Wynn Hervey of Fresh Prince. I read Terry Winter's scripts. I think they're really good. I'd like to maybe have him in to pitch some ideas. So I was really excited. I called Doug in New York, and he was gone for the weekend. It was 4 o'clock in L.A., and it was Friday night in New York. And I thought, oh, God, he's gone. I got to wait till Monday now. And then I thought, well, you know, he doesn't really know anything about being an agent either. So I can just call and say I'm him and cut out the middleman. So I called, and I said I was him. And she said, yeah, you know, we're having Terry – you know, we like to have Terry in to pitch ideas. And she said, you know, Fresh Prince is sort of a teenage-oriented show. Does he have one more script that, you know, maybe is kind of teenage-y? And I said, yeah, he's got – he just finished a great Wonder Years spec, which was a lie. She had everything I had written at that point. And I said, but, you know, Terry's out of town for the weekend. I could probably get it to you like by Tuesday. So she said, yeah, great. Tuesday's fine. So I hung up the phone and from Friday night until Tuesday afternoon, I cranked out a Wonder Years script. Then I threw my baseball hat back on when as the messenger again. Said, yeah, here's the messenger.
So you're the messenger, the agent,
I'm everybody,
and the writer?
Janitor. Yeah. Full service agency. So I gave them the script and they had me in the pitch ideas and that was sort of my first foot in the door. And it was great. And shortly thereafter, I got into a program Warner Brothers runs, which is a godsend for writers, called the Warner Brothers Sitcom Writers Workshop. They also run a show for drama writers. But at the time, I wanted to be a sitcom writer. And at the end of the show, they called me in at the end of the 10 weeks and they said, we have an interesting situation. We have a show. It's not a sitcom, but it's a drama that has a lot of comedy in it. And I said, well, why me? And they said, well, it's about a blue-collar guy who becomes a lawyer for a stuffy white-collar firm. Do you think you could write that? And I said, yeah. I said, if I don't get this job, I'm leaving. Yeah. I'm getting on a plane. And that was my first job. It was a show called The Great Defender. Co-created by a guy named Frank Renzulli, who then mm-hmm. later on went to be one of the writers on The Sopranos.
All right. Well, Terrence Winter, thanks very much for being on Fresh Air.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you, David.
Terrence Winter, creator of the new period drama series Boardwalk Empire, which is televised Sundays on HBO. Our next guest, Jim Parsons, recently won the Emmy as Outstanding Actor in a Comedy Series. He's a star of The Big Bang Theory, a CBS sitcom co-created by Chuck Lorre, whose other credits include 2 1/2 Men and the new Mike and Molly. Jim Parsons has appeared in regional theater and in bit parts in a few movies and TV pilots, but The Big Bang Theory was his big break. He plays Sheldon Cooper, a physicist who's brilliant at math and other things, but baffled by what most of us would consider basic social situations. He does have friends, though. Johnny Galecki from Roseanne co-stars as his equally bright roommate, Leonard. And Kaylee Cuoco plays Penny, the beautiful girl who lives in the apartment across the hall. This season, Jim Parsons Sheldon has a girlfriend of his own. She's a fellow genius named Amy, who's just as geeky, as you can tell from last week's fourth season premiere when he got a text message from her.
Excuse me. Oh, Amy's at the dry cleaners and she's made a very amusing pun. I don't care for perchloroethylene and I don't like glycol ether. Get it? She doesn't like glycol ether. Sounds like either.
Jim Parsons, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, congratulations on your recent Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series. And the setup of the show almost threatens to make fun of nerds or brainy people, but the show doesn't really do that at all. Can you talk about mm-hmm. the authenticity of both the characters and the science?
Well, the science part is extremely easy. We employ David Salzberg, who is a physicist who teaches at UCLA, and he not only fact checks, he supplies a great deal of it. You know, it's like we need Sheldon to talk about, you know, something or other that somehow applies to teaching Penny, whatever, mm-hmm. and he'll come up with something. You know, he sends over this diagram can go on this whiteboard, and he'll throw in little inside jokes that, you know, I don't find funny because I don't know what the heck he's talking about. But and then as far as the more geek culture, I guess you'd call it, between the gaming and the comic books and Star Trek and whatever you have, I think that we just have a fair amount of writers employed who totally know it. and I don't. And every once in a while you'll hear a verbal disagreement break out. But, you know, the setup would lend itself, you would think. And we got a lot of buzz that are they just going to poke fun at geeks for, you know, a few episodes and hopefully we'll be rid of this show, whatever, when we first came on. And it was such a more affectionate embrace of these characters than ever that. And I think that's what is one of the major keys to this show working is, like I say, that affection on the part of everybody working on it for these characters. And I think that engenders affection, hopefully, from the audience.
Some people have presumed or suggested that Sheldon is borderline autistic or has Asperger's syndrome. I know mm-hmm. you've asked the writers and they've told you mm-hmm. no. Mm-hmm. But the way that you play him, is that a possibility mm-hmm. in your mind?
I did not know enough about Asperger's to be utilizing any Aspergian traits, as it were, early on. And I still didn't know what it meant exactly to have Asperger's or what those qualities were in a human with that until we were being asked about midway through the first season after having aired several episodes, you know, does Sheldon have Asperger's? And that's, you know, my first question, like you said, was I went to the writers and asked. They said no. And then I began a very slight foray into just researching, like, what is this? And, you know, then I read and was like, oh, well, okay, they say he doesn't have Asperger's and they wrote it, so I trust them. But good grief, he certainly has a lot of the traits. So I've looked no further into that as far as trying to get any guidance from that. For one reason, whatever they're writing, the way it's being filtered through me and the way I'm doing it apparently is leading us in that direction anyway without having to think about it. Who knew? But the other thing is, and I think they were very smart when they said, nope, he doesn't, is that that's not what they wanted to do. Not that they've ever told me this, but it seems to me it's such an original reaction to the world through a filter like that, to look at the world through those eyes. But I think that they, you know, for however long we're lucky enough to keep doing this show, I don't think they wanted to saddle us with a responsibility. I don't think they wanted to, I would assume, claim something that we were suddenly had mm-hmm. to make sure we upheld to the letter for 10 years, if we're lucky, you know, or whatever. I certainly am relieved as an actor that I'm not constantly having to fact check. Look, trying to figure out what the Spock sign, the Vulcan salute is every time we do it. So I can only imagine what I'd be doing going, now, is this actually what an Asperger's, you know, somebody with Asperger's would do or autism? So I feel like they've made my life freer in that way by not doing that.
You had a really interesting challenge last season when one episode was built as a lengthy flashback to show how Sheldon and Leonard first met.
Oh, yes.
to play Sheldon pre-Leonard, what adjustments did you make and why?
Basically, they said, you know, we're going to flashback. And whereas the other three guys are going to have physically changed, Sheldon will look identically the same, and only his dealings with people and the world around him will have evolved. That's what has changed about him, which is a wonderful conceit. But it's very hard after working on something for nearly 3 years at that point to go, and now I don't talk like this anymore. Mm-hmm. Now I don't look at people and I don't blah, 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 whatever.
Well, let's play a clip okay. from the flashback episode. The plot has Sheldon. This is the less socialized Sheldon advertising for a new roommate, but he's got very tough standards, as Leonard learns when he knocks on Sheldon's door. So you have Johnny Galecki playing Leonard and our guest, Jim Parsons, playing Sheldon.
Yes?
I'm Leonard Hofstetter. I called you about the apartment. You said to come
by. I said. I know what you said. I know what my mother said on March 5th, 1992. What is the sixth noble gas?
What?
You said you're a scientist. What is the sixth noble gas?
Radon?
Are you asking me or telling me?
Telling you? Telling you.
All right. Next question. Kirk or Picard?
Well, that's tricky. Original series over Next Generation, but Picard over Kirk.
Correct. You've passed the first barrier to roommatehood. You may enter.
That's Johnny Galecki and our guest Jim Parsons in a flashback episode of the CBS sitcom The Big Bang Theory. Jim, you're 37, but you look and play so much younger.
Thank you, God.
And you seem to really get this character. I know you grew up in Houston, but What was your own childhood like? What could you draw from that would make you understand Sheldon this well?
I was a very shy child. I remember being very early in, I think it was kindergarten open house or whatever, and being with my mother and children saying hi to me or other children that were in my class. And I still remember feeling this way, but I don't know why. I wouldn't even say hi back. I was that shy. And I remember her gripping my hand and saying, "You say hi." And I'm sorry, Mother. She's not a tyrant by any stretch. This is just like in my DNA. This is who I was. And the reason I do start there is that I think there's something I understand about his lack of understanding about what is it that other people want to hear? What is it that they want me to answer? I feel like, you know, when I've been asked this question in this conversation, I don't know that what I'm about to say is what they is normal, is what they're expecting. Or now, I think for Sheldon, it's different. You know, he's more obtuse than I. He's not even thinking that far into it normally. Like, oh dear, I don't want to hurt their feelings. In fact, that's one of the keys to him, I think, as a character, is that He says things all the time that could hurt someone's feelings. But the reason he gets away with it is because it wouldn't occur to him. He didn't check it through a filter and go, oh, they'll be fine with this. No, we skip that barrier completely. He just says it. But in that, there's something I understand about maybe feeling like you haven't understood the question exactly.
How early did you go from being a shy kid to being a kid who wanted to be up on stage and acting?
What's funny is that if that open house where I was so painfully shy that my mother was upset with me was in kindergarten, my first play was in first grade. And
so your trauma didn't last very long.
You know, I don't think it ever went away. I still feel pretty I'm not the best social person. It's a matter of comfort, I think. And for whatever reason, the same way I don't know why I was so painfully shy at the age of 5, I don't know why I was so comfortable playing the bird in the first grade show and doing a little solo in yellow tights, which I did willingly, happily, you know, caught the bug, as it were. But it's a matter of comfort, and it's a matter of understanding the situation you're in. And there's still something about walking down a hall and people saying hi that can throw me. But if I have the script and I understand where we're going with this story and what story I'm helping tell, then I'm very comfortable because I can see there's something about knowing where the end is. And maybe that's all it is I don't know outside of the script where the rest of this life leads. And that makes me a little more anxious. I don't know.
Tell me if this is too personal a question.
Okay.
I know that your father died in a car accident about 10 years ago.
Yes.
At what point in your life were you then professionally, personally, and looking back on it, how did you react and what did that mean to you?
I was in graduate school for acting at that point. I was 27 at that point. And my father was really the one who was very eager that I explore this desire to be an actor. Not that I got a lot of flack from anybody. You know, my mother didn't call me and say, "What are you doing?" Nothing like that. But it was, I did find out in retrospect, he was certainly the voice who told her that they needed to let me try, you know. And there's no repaying the gratitude that I feel on that level, because I've been around too many people who weren't supported as much as I was, say, at home in that way. And I don't mean just financially, although there was some help, but not, you know, we weren't rich. But more emotionally, just like I say, getting no flack from them, like, this needs to stop. Instead, they would pose questions to me like, what are you doing to make a real financial go of this? You know, what is your next step? What's the whatever? Which kind of led me to grad school, etc. I had one experience in grad school that was very important where, coincidentally, I was an understudy for a very big part in one of the main shows at the regional theater where we were studying, the Old Globe. And the guy who I was understudying, his grandmother passed away, and he had to go to the funeral for her, and I had to go on for him. And purely coincidentally, my parents were visiting me that weekend at school. They got to see me go on, and it was a wonderful experience, this adrenaline rush of a moment with this full paying audience at a, you know, an equity regional theater, and it was just a professional thing going on. And I will never forget that, getting to spend that one day with them when they got to watch that and got to be around everybody else watching it. And, you know, while he, my father hasn't seen, you know, from Earth at least with us, he hasn't seen anything that's gone on in the regard of the past 10 years. He did see the first toe into the water of making a real professional go of this, I feel.
We're talking with Jim Parsons, the Emmy-winning star of The Big Bang Theory on CBS. Are you used to that yet, Emmy-winning?
No. This is weird, but that night a couple people said, "How do you feel?" I said, "I feel like I'm kind of dreaming." And they're like, "Give it a week, give it a week." And I thought, well, how weird to have a timeline on your acceptance of an Emmy. What a ridiculous thing to say. But it was very accurate. And here we are, I don't know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks out, whatever, and what's changed is not that I've accepted it and become comfortable with Emmy winner. It's that now it feels less like it happened. Now I look back and go, I can't believe that really happened. So it's gone from being unreal to as if it just didn't happen.
Well,
it's an odd thing.
It did happen.
It did. Yeah. I know. I know I was there. I hugged LL Cool J.
Well, Jim Parsons, thanks so much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jim Parsons, Emmy-winning star of The Big Bang Theory. The CBS comedy Moved at the start of this season and now airs on Thursdays.